place around the world?
Performed at the Improv on Melrose. I performed in London.
What she's trying to say is she gets around.
Yeah.
With a diehard fan base addicted to a good belly laugh, he was a staple on Melbourne Breakfast Radio for over 10 years, making him a household name on Fox FM alongside Matt Tilley and Joe Stanley. He has worked in front and behind the scenes with his quick wit, forging him an envious television career. You may have seen him on Spicks and Specs, Rove Live, and even on Celebrity Splash. He is a fantastic addition to any morning show, with a laugh so infectious that it's no wonder that this person has the word fabulous before his name. Although that's kind of going, isn't it?
Oh, look, you know, I work at the ABC now. They can't afford it. I'm the affordable Adam Richard.
I would like to welcome you, and I'd like to welcome Adam Richard.
We have the fabulous Adam Richard.
He's a comedian who's also the bitchiest gossip queen ever to appear on Breakfast Radio.
Adam Richards, who plays the role of Jesus.
I did celebrity gossip on radio for 10 years.
If Joan Rivers had sex with Twitter, the result would be Adam Richards.
Do you ever regret anything you say when you're performing?
Oh, I've regretted a lot of stuff I've done in my life.
Adam Richard, everyone.
Do you know what's funny? I got so excited about coming in here to do this, and my partner also was so excited because he grew up listening to you as well.
Oh, God, don't make me feel so old. I'm 29. I must have been 9 when that was happening.
Exactly. I love that we're already going to try and lie about our age at this stage. But he was saying Adam Richards.
Yeah, people do. And
do you correct people on that?
Sometimes. And sometimes I'm just like, well, I do take up a lot of room. It is like I'm plural. Because I'm fat, listeners. Fat. you know what? I went to the movies the other week, saw I, Tonya. Mm. In the film, the first time you meet Alison Janney's character, the song Devil Woman by Cliff Richard is playing.
I love it.
Glorious.
Just love it.
And then got to the end of the movie and, you know, of course, they have all the music credits. I sit through all the credits because when you work in this industry, you go, a lot of people worked on that film and I'm going to sit here and I'm not going to read their names, but I'm going to at least sit here while they go past me. but yeah, the music credits came up right at the end and there, Devil Woman, Cliff Richards. And I'm
really?
Like, it even happens to Cliff. I feel so special now. I'm in the same category as Cliff.
I wonder if he sat in the cinema and waited for his name.
And oh, then God. Went, S? There's no S in my name.
Just like Adam Richards? I mean, Adam Richard?
Do you know the other thing? The reason, like, my surname is Delamata, and I changed it because people couldn't spell it. Now the irony is people can't spell Richard.
Which is weird, because, like, as you were growing up, that's your name. So, like, people at school would really have known you as
Delamata, yeah.
Yeah.
Or Della. Daily Fada, Mortadella. You know, many names.
But does that mean that you missed out on people always going, oh, I went to school with him?
No, I don't want to be associated with those people.
Well, let's be honest, you did grow up in the north, so
I grew up in Brunswick, which is trendy now, but then was a slum.
It wasn't always like that, though, was it?
It was not. It was horrific. It was, yeah, it was really poor. It was, yeah, we lived below the poverty line.
And what were you like as a kid when you were growing up?
Oh, precocious. I spoke very clearly and loudly. And there was only one word I couldn't say, and that was the word truck. And I loved trucks, and I would point at them and yell at my mother, look, mummy, there is a truck, but I was using the sound.
Oh, okay, I think you worked that one out.
Yeah, and so she'd be on the tram and like, yeah, shush, honey, we, God.
Yeah, don't be screaming that out.
Yeah, no, I was, really loud.
I thought for a minute there that you were going to say that it was the word tuck, and I thought, years before his time, just pointing out tucks from RuPaul's Drag Race.
Yes, look at that lady. She's not really a lady.
What an excellent tuck. But apart from being precocious, though, like, how else would you describe yourself as a kid?
Nerdy. I was really nerdy. I was totally into Doctor Who from about the age of 5 years old. Like, I had a Doctor Who club when I was at primary school.
Oh, wow.
Like, grade 6. I made people come to my house and sit in, like, we had, like, a shed at the back and they would have to sit around in a circle and I would hand out my photocopied copies of the Doctor Who newsletter that I'd written for them to, or they, none of them liked Doctor Who. They just did what they were told.
To be there. Yeah.
Or my sister would bash them up. She's younger than me, but
she probably rounded them up to get in there to hang out at your Doctor Who club.
Yeah, she didn't like Doctor Who either.
Well, how many siblings did you have growing up?
Just my sister, my younger sister.
And so she was younger?
Yeah.
And yet she'd bash them up and bring them in?
Yeah, she's way butcher than I am.
Not hard, my friend.
I know. She's very pretty and glamorous and very feminine and still way butcher than I am.
And so what's the age difference between the two of you?
2.5 years.
And what was your relationship like?
Oh, amazing. Like, still. Like, I'm staying with her now while I'm in Melbourne.
Yeah, wow. Yeah. And what's your relationship like then with your parents?
My mother passed away a week after my first gig.
But she at least got to go along.
Never saw me perform.
So she missed the first gig as well?
Yeah. I didn't tell anyone I was doing it. Because I'd seen a whole bunch of, like, I didn't really want to do stand-up. It was not something I was interested in. Mm. I was friends with Corinne Grant when she was kind of doing middle brackets and stuff. And it's not as bad now, but back then it was really intimidating for a woman to do stand-up because there was only ever one woman on the bill and you'd have to sit backstage with these very alpha male people and it was kind of horrific. So she would kind of drag me along to gigs just sort of so there was someone there that she could talk to without feeling threatened.
Yeah, right.
So I saw a lot of gigs and was going to a lot of gigs and then kind of got talked into it by a mutual friend who was running a room. And I was like, oh, yeah, all right, I'll do a gig. And he goes, all right, I'll book you in March. This is at a Christmas party. I was like, oh, no, this week.
Yeah, I'm doing it now, bitch, or not at all.
Yeah. Doing it on Sunday or it's not happening. I'd seen a lot of people do, because I'd been to a lot of these rooms, I'd seen a lot of people do first gigs. And also my friend Katie from school is the daughter of John Pinder, who pretty much started the comedy festival, like big figure in comedy. So she was working at Token when they first started, which is a big management company. Mm. And I would get dragged a lot. So I was in comedy a lot. I was around. So I'd seen a lot of people do very first gigs and they would always load it up with their friends and family. So there'd always be one corner of the room laughing hilariously.
Because they had to.
At one person.
Yeah.
And then the rest of the room would be like, this is offensive. There is the audience like, why is that corner of table laughing and no one else?
Is that sort of where sort of your humour then comes in? Like, do you think in some ways when you were growing up, you know, what sort of role did you play with your family, like with your sister and your parents?
Well, look, I've talked about this in therapy a bit.
I'm your therapist today.
Yeah.
It's only being broadcast.
So my dad was an alcoholic and violent. So humor was like a coping mechanism for both my sister and I. And if he was laughing, he wasn't angry. So, you know, being hilarious and making people giggle was pretty much inbred in us because it was a survival tactic. It wasn't something we chose to do. It was something we needed to do because they were the days we weren't getting hit.
It's a way of life in some ways. And you do speak to a lot of kids that are in domestic violence situations. Mm. They usually will use humour as a coping mechanism.
Yeah.
And for you, it was obviously so prevalent that you were just so goddamn funny.
Oh, it's... Well, I mean, you know, me and Michelle used to do these bizarre little sketch things like Dad would be there doing, you know, drunkenly trying to do his contact lens bullshit, which seemed to take up the whole kitchen table because he was incapable of just sticking a finger in his eye. But, you know, he'd be doing this routine and he used to get angry and frustrated while he was doing it. And sometimes that would, you know, somehow be our fault. So we used to do this bizarre routine while he was doing that where Michelle would sit down with a tablecloth in the top of her shirt and have a bowl of cereal and then I would be her arms and just be throwing
which is hilarious.
Food into her face, like missing her mouth and getting it in her hair. And he would sit there piercing himself with laughter. And that was one of those moments where you're like, okay, phew, we've got a night off.
Isn't that so interesting, though, that was something that you'd worked out to do? Because, I mean, with children, they're working stuff out as they go.
Yeah.
And so it's not like it's a thought-out thing.
Mm.
You were doing that.
It was instinctive.
Yeah. So did your parents split up then?
No.
She stayed.
Yeah, she stayed until I think I was maybe 17. I must have been 17. I was doing, or 18. I was doing year 12. And I pretty much told my mum if she didn't leave, I was going to take Michelle and she would never see us again. So.
And did that end up happening?
No. I think she realised I was serious. And so she was like, oh, all right, we'll go. She was begrudging, but yeah. And then she kind of, you know, found herself again, which was amazing, seeing her suddenly blossom as a person instead of this terrified woman stuck in this house.
You think about a lot of people go through that. You know, I'm sure there's lots of people listening to this right now and they go, that was me.
Mm.
You know, and you think there's not one just way out of that, you know, for a mum.
No.
Wants to look after their kids, you know.
Yeah.
It's not like they want to put you there.
No.
And so how long was she then alive for?
Well, it felt like a really long time, but now as that I'm 47, I'm like, oh, actually, it wasn't that long. I was 25. That was, oh, God, 21 years ago now?
It's crazy when you think of that because, like, when you're growing up or when you're being a young adult, I guess you kind of feel like things are going to be forever.
Yeah.
And then when it happens, I lost my father when I was 26. Mm-hmm. And so now, reflective, I look back and I felt like at the time that it would never seem like it was a short time.
Was it sudden, your dad?
Yeah, he committed suicide.
Oh, my God, I'm so sorry.
Which, like, I know for me, you know, losing a parent's really hard, but would it have been important to you for her to have seen what you've achieved?
Look, I would have loved her to see it, but it's not, yeah. You know, it's not something that could possibly ever happen. Like, that's not, you know, I've done a lot of, you know, the crazy mindfulness stuff, which is where you live in the moment. So that's a thing that is in the past and could never happen. So it's a future that can't happen. It's a past that you don't need to worry about. And for right now, it's neither here nor there. It doesn't help me. It doesn't. Yeah, there's no
trying to let it go.
Yeah, it's like, you know, my mum did everything she possibly could up to when she passed, and you know, I had this weird, like, it feels like a weird filmic moment. It's like if you saw this in a movie, you go, oh, that's too convenient. The night, so she died on Boxing Day, and on Christmas Day my sister was ill and we had to go to the hospital and we were there for ages and then went back home and Michelle was asleep all day, and Mum and I were just having, you know, one of those weird, it's Christmas, let's talk about everything conversations. And, you know, the one thing that bothered me about her when I was a little kid was when I cried, she would laugh. And I thought she was nasty and vindictive and that she was making me cry. And she thought it was hilarious. And she's like, oh, she was like, I so didn't want to laugh. She goes, I tried not to, but you both looked so funny with your little screwed up faces. And I'm like, oh my God. And I was 25 at that point. And my mum was 25 when I was born. And it was just, you know, you just connect things in your head. And I went, oh my God, if I had a kid now, I would have no idea what to do with it as a 25-year-old. And it was just one of those moments where you're like, oh, my mum is a human. She was once this age. She has made mistakes. Like, she is, has feet of clay. Like, you know, she's a normal person. And it was like, and she died suddenly the next day. Like, it was not expected. And so it was just such a bizarre moment of, you know, it was upsetting and it was distressing. But it's kind of one of these things that I've kind of carried with me. It's like, oh, I felt like I had my last conversation with my mum and it was exactly the conversation I needed to have. I know it sounds like something you would write. It doesn't sound like when I tell the story, I feel like it sounds so convenient, but that is the actual truth of what happened that day, and that's what stayed with me.
When you look at a lot of people who are as prolific as you, there's usually stories behind that are rich, complex places.
I mean, you know, there's no such thing as the Brady Bunch family. Like, that was, even if you look at the Brady Bunch, it was a broken home. Like, they were two separate families. Yeah. It seemed ideal on the television because it's like, oh, everything's nice and it seemed perfect. But then you look into it, you're like, well, what happened to the others? Like, was he a widower? Was she divorced? Like, that was never really explained. It was just, oh, yeah, we've got these two families. We've joined them together from previous marriages. And you're like, well, there's some darkness under the Brady Brady household.
If you had the opportunity of going back and talking to Adam as a 12-year-old, what advice would you give yourself?
The world's not going to end.
Like, did you think that at the time?
Oh, yeah. When I was 12, I would have been 83. Still 29. Don't do the maths. Please stop adding that up. Oh, all right, I'm 47.
They just worked it out.
The Cold War was not that cold at the time.
Yeah.
Like, Reagan was in charge. It was a little bit terrifying. Mm. Like, I was reading comic books a lot. So by the time I got to 85, it was my favourite comic book ever. The Watchmen was coming out every month. Very kind of terrifying nuclear paranoia. You know, The Day After was on the television. Mm. It was, I honestly believe, because there was a lot of talk about Australia's bicentenary, which is just the bicentenary of the First Fleet. I honestly did not think the world would be around.
Wow.
In that time.
It made such an impact that it gave you anxiety.
Well, yeah. So when the Berlin Wall came down, it was just like, oh, well, what do we do now? Also, 83 was when you started to hear a lot of news reports about AIDS, and I knew I was gay. Like, there was never a conflict about that. There was a conflict about telling people about it, but I had never thought of anything else.
Like, so you reckon at 12 you worked it out?
Oh, before. Like, it just...
Was it when you wanted a Barbie, or was it... Do you know...
Yeah, I used to play with my sister's Barbies. I mean, I played with cars as well.
Yeah.
I loved the Thunderbirds as much as I, you know, loved watching soap operas with my grandmother. Like, you know, these were all my favourite things. But, yeah, I
think I worked it out when I would remind my grandparents that the Golden Girls was going to be on.
Oh, yeah.
Friday night, 7:30, Grandma.
When it used to be the Muppets one week and every fortnight was Golden Girls, so back and forth, I was like, this is ideal. I love both of these things.
I think I was raised on both of those things.
You know, my heroes when I was a kid were people like Dick Emery and Mr. Humphries and Are You Being Served? Kenneth Williams. I loved any Carry On movie where, you know, Bernard Breslau would dress as a nurse. He's like 6'6". Wearing a dress. Like, I found all of that hilarious. Like, so I've always enjoyed camp humour. That doesn't necessarily mean you're going to end up being gay, but it just...
It's starting for you to work out who you are.
And when you're starting to work out what's attractive, it's, you know, women were never really in the... Women were always my friends. Like, I was always friends with girls, and boys I was scared of, and, you know, they made me nervous.
Well, I remember being at school and a teacher came over and said to me, you're sitting with the wrong kids. Because I was sitting with a bunch of girls talking about Melrose Place.
Good girl.
Yeah. That makes it seem as though with your childhood, your parents or people around you might have worked out your sexuality before you
did. Yeah. And my uncle is gay. And, you know, it travels diagonally through families.
That's where I have a gay uncle comes from.
Yeah.
Strangely enough, all my uncles are straight, so that's not me giving anything away.
And that was one of those moments where my dad had said something horrendous about my uncle to my mum. And I just ran and went, Mum, Dad called Uncle Paul a poofter. And she goes, well, look, I love my brother no matter what. And it was one of those moments where my head just almost opened up. And I went, oh, thank God. Like, it was just a moment of feeling everything was fine. And that is one of the reasons why every year when I couldn't face getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning anymore and thought, I can't do this job, I'm sick of talking about Lindsay Lohan on the radio, I'm done with it, that, you know, it'd be contract negotiation time. And I would just think of some kid at the age of 10 or 11 in the car with his mum laughing hysterically at me and, you know, just them knowing that their mum was okay with a gay person that they'd never met. That when it came time to say something about it, they'd be like, oh, mum's going to be fine. She loves Fabulous Adam.
I mean, you couldn't count how many times that must have happened.
I know. We had a million listeners. Our cume was a million listeners in a city of 3 million people.
I love, though, that your mum gave a little bit of a glimpse of the opportunity for you to know that it wasn't going to be the burden that you thought it was. But you also mentioned earlier that once you did know, there was a struggle. So what was the struggle then for you coming to terms with telling people?
Oh, it was because, you know, as I'm coming to terms with my sexuality, I'm being told it's going to kill you. You are going to die. So not only I'm either going to get blown up by an atomic bomb or the Grim Reaper's going to bowl me down in a bowling alley. Like, it was...
And you're going to get fall over like a bottle of milk.
Yeah, and it was, you know, you could get AIDS from kissing someone. Like, you know, there was all this kind of, you know, it was so terrifying. And, yeah, and I ended up spending a lot of time kind of doing stuff with, like, the AIDS Council, even back then, you know, when I was kind of 17, 18 years old, just because I wanted information. I wanted to know what the danger was, like what did you do? What made things safe? Because it's like, well, I can't not have sex. I'm not Cliff Richard.
You're certainly not Richard. I've heard some stories.
But yeah, I can't. Yeah, you know, it's, and you want to do the fun thing, and it's like, well, how do I do the fun thing? And
so would
not
you say
die?
Though then the fear though of death to do with your sexuality was more potent or more scary than people knowing your sexuality?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like everyone at school pretty much knew I was gay. I mean, listen to how I talk. It's like I've got a tattoo.
On your face. It's like you have a tattoo on your face.
That just says, a woolly woofter right there on my cheek.
I think it's so strange, though. Like, obviously, over time, you sort of worked out your sexuality and you worked out that you were comfortable with it, which has to be a part of your story because, you know, you can't be who you are without being comfortable about it. Mm. What age was it that you worked out that you're comfortable with your sexuality?
Oh, I reckon maybe 15? 16?
Yeah, wow.
I mean, also, don't forget, like, 83, I know I keep weird magical year when I was 12 years old, but, you know, Boy George was a big thing, Marilyn, that whole gender-bending thing, you know, sexual fluidity was kind of becoming a thing, men would wear makeup. It was... And I went to school in Carlton, which, you know, inner city school, it was starting to become gentrified. So, yeah, it was kind of, it wasn't entirely okay with everyone, but it was kind of, you know, most of the girls who were my friends were like, nah, don't worry about it. And many of the boys, especially the ones that I was having sex with. But so, yeah, it was kind of okay. And it was, you know, me being me was, it was easier being me than pretending not to be.
Moving into your career, what or when did you work out that you could make money from making people laugh?
I did, like, you know, I did school plays and stuff.
Yeah.
We did Bye Bye Birdie at school, and for the audition, they kind of had me pegged to play the dad, Harry McAfee, in Bye Bye Birdie, which in the film is Paul Lynde, you know, Uncle Arthur from Bewitched, the campus man who ever lived. And so I did the first reading, very gruff and manly, and they said, oh, can you do it a little camper? And I was like, sure. And then I did the gayest voice you've ever heard, like gayer than my normal voice, like, sorry, oh my God.
And then you never stopped.
Way over the top voice. And then, like, the whole, everyone there just lost their minds laughing. And the teacher was like, parents will be upset by that. Go back to what you're doing before. I think they thought I might just be a little bit camp and they didn't expect, oh, the onslaught.
But isn't that amazing? They probably asked you to pull it back. But to be honest, let's look at your career, you know, before, now and forever, what it's going to be. Mm. And that is that you make being gay hilarious without offending gays.
Oh, no, sometimes I do.
And if you did, so they should be, because they're obviously too sensitive. But, like, you still make it accessible to straight people.
Also, it's not everything I do. Like, I won't remove it from what I do. I refuse to do something where, you know, it's like, oh, let's, you know, can you tone it down a bit? It's like, well, now you're asking me to ramp it up, aren't you? The worst was when I first started at Fox. So I did my first, like, I do this on stage, a stand-up, but it's an absolutely true story where I did, you know, whatever the morning's gossip was about Nicole Kidman or something. Dang, she's paralyzed from the neck up.
You should laugh at that. What's wrong with me?
So, yeah, I'd done that and we were having the meeting afterwards. They're like, Adam, we love the content. It's really good. We're just wondering if you could sound a little bit gayer. And I, without missing a beat, this is seriously what I said. I went, yes, I can. How's this? And they went, yep, okay, fine. Just keep doing what you're doing.
Was that the point where they told you to turn it up or turn it down?
They just said, please don't mind having, doing oral on the radio. That is not okay.
So did you ever do that on Fox FM? Did you ever go far as being explicit like that? Or did you know?
No.
Or did
you know? Broadcasting standards. Like there's, you know, there are kids in cars. Like for the same reason that I wanted to do the job, I couldn't be revolting.
Yeah.
Like, you know, if I was revolting, then mums would be like, ugh.
You walked a very fine line on a tightrope for 10 years on Metro radio station, but you still were never fired for being too over the top.
No.
Can you tell me what the closest, though, is to being fired for being too over the top? Do you have a memory of you going,
no,
shouldn't have said that?
We all did that. Like, you know, you do 3 hours of radio a day. Probably about once a week that happened. We used to have, we used to call it Under the Cover of Darkness. So 6 to 7, which is mostly just truckies listening. Like, kind of taking a run up at the day.
Yeah.
So you could say anything in that hour. No one ever knew. In fact, all the stuff that Kyle usually got in trouble for was the 6 o'clock hour.
Like, because he thought he could get away with it.
Well, we all thought we could. Mm. Like, we didn't know people were recording the show and playing it back later to try and write a bad story about it. Like, which is what was happening to Kyle.
It's called jealous people.
Yeah, there's that. Also, you know, it's the other thing is, like, people don't. Like, I knew people who'd been doing radio. Like, I'm still very good friends with Will Anderson, and he'd been doing Brekkie radio for, like, 5 years, I think, by the time I started. And he gave me a lot of advice about how to do it. Like, so when you do stand-up, like, it's a big thing. And sometimes stand-ups come in and do radio, and they're selling it to the back of the room, and it's like, mate, there is not a huge audience here. The person you're talking to is the one across from you,
and that is it.
And the one other person who you can't see.
In the car.
Mm. Or
wherever they are.
With their headphones on, or at the shops, or making the kids' lunches, or whatever. But, yeah, you're only just talking to one other person. Yes, you know, in our case, we had a million one other people, but they were just one at a time.
So you don't necessarily need to overdo it.
Yeah, you're not selling anything to the back of the room. Like, like we're doing now, we're having a chat. Like, if I was doing stand-up, I would be talking like this because I'd be talking to an entire room full of... And it's a very different...
But from doing Breakfast Radio, you would know that when people come in and do that, it's actually almost frustrating.
Oh, it's horrible.
And you go, you're sitting there going, please, no, just I want to give you so much advice.
Rein it in.
The way I looked at it when I thought about talking to you for this series is that you are... the first real gay person who was flawed in a way that was able to be on Metro Radio. There was no one in Metro Radio that had ever done what you'd done, as far as I'm concerned.
I mean, there were a lot of gay people that just weren't open about it.
You were out, you were proud. It was almost like a role model for being that way.
Yeah, and it was, you know. Also, the other thing, and this happens with me a lot, like I would get cast in things or someone would invite me to something, they'd be like, oh, I didn't realise you looked like that. And it's like, people expect me to turn up and look like Creasy. Like, Creasy, I think, is... Joel Creasy is one of those people that are like, oh, yeah, he looks like a gay person. Mm. He's been to the gym, he's had his hair done, he's wearing nice clothes. It's like, I turn up in my 4XL Target outfits. People are like, oh, we wanted a stereotypical poofter and you've come here looking like this. And I'm like, yes, I am a shambles.
I'm a type of gay person. But, I mean, that's kind of funny because you do get classified in certain ways. What kind of study did you do to get into this? Was there any kind of formative work?
Yeah, there was. I was doing a course in professional writing and editing at RMIT.
Yeah.
Which I never passed because I was no good at the editing and it was a required subject. But I had an amazing playwriting teacher, Peter Murray, one of the greatest playwrights this country's ever produced, Augie-winning, incredible author. And so, yeah, I was doing her playwriting course and we learned about the structure of comedy, the structure of theatre. I think she had done stand-up at one point and I had not done stand-up. Like, I would occasionally host, like, a spoken word night.
Yeah.
And would be reading my stories out and things. And then, you know, realised that stand-up, essentially, you could do all the funny bits and not have to worry about the narrative.
And no story.
Yeah. And so, because especially when, you know, when you first start out, you do 5-minute spots. Like now I can tell a story because I'm a headliner and I get like half an hour to an hour. But, you know, when you're doing 5-minute spots, it's just gags. And, yeah, so the structure of the writing, I had a huge foundation in. But the performance is a whole... stand-up is a craft. Like, there's a whole bunch of things you need to learn to do. And then you have to be funny on top of it.
So the very first paid gig that you ever had was what?
My first paid gig, I think it was my 6th ever gig was paid, which is, you know, pretty spectacular. Mm. My 5th ever gig was like a raw comedy heat. My 6th gig was a paid gig. I was supporting Simon Pegg. There's another name to drop.
That's a good one to drop.
At the Last Laugh, which is,
wow,
you know, now just some pub on the corner in Collingwood on
but
Smith
still,
Street.
On your resume, open for Simon Pegg.
Yeah.
Was that a taste for it and you were like, this is where I'm going? And you
Yeah, it's been 21 years and I still get $50.
You just do a lot more gigs.
Yeah. The pay has not changed, seriously. In fact, I get less now than, like, working in Sydney. Sydney used to get $200, $250 for a headline spot. Now it's about $100, $150.
The name Fabulous Adam Richard, where did that come about?
That was at the radio. Hamish Blake used to do the breakfast show before I came in, and he went off to do Hamish and Andy, which they used to do for free on a Monday night. I know. Where are they now? Where they haven't kicked on at all, those assholes. But yeah, when Hamish was on the show, when it was Matt and Tracy, they used to call him Street Bitch. And they were never allowed to call him Hamish. Like, he just had to always be Street Bitch. And so Matt Tilley said, well, whatever we call Adam for his gossip segment, that's what we'll call him all the time.
Yeah, right.
And I hilariously suggested, because I wanted my name to be used, because, you know what, I assumed it was going to last maybe 3 or 4 months.
Yeah.
And then I'd...
At best, yeah.
Yeah, I'd get fired and then, you know, see you later, and no one would know who I was, because on the radio I was, you know...
Street Bitch or whatever.
Yeah, TV Bitch or whatever. And I suggested, what about the fabulous Adam Richard? Like, that says gay, doesn't it? And they're like, it really does. And so for about the first 3 years, the show was called The Matt and Joe Show with the Fabulous Adam Richard. It was like three lines in the Green Guide. Like, my name took up more room than the two stars.
I remember this. But then how did that show come about? Like, how did you end up on that show?
There were three of us. I mean, there were a lot of people we've been in for auditions. Like, I remember seeing Dom Gleason there. I saw, like, everyone in the world. Like, Tracy was going and they wanted to start a new show. Joe already had the job, pretty much, and they just wanted a third person. And I'd been working really well with Joe, and she'd been working with Jody J. Hill. They'd been doing a morning show, so 9 to 10, and I did a spot with them once a week. And I kind of rang up and said, you know, I'd been to Sydney for a couple of weeks. I was like, oh, I'm ready to come back. You know, we're still doing the show. And they went, oh, no, that show's been cancelled. I was like, oh, all right. And then about 3 months later, it's like, do you want to come in and try out for this? So I went and did an audition, and they've narrowed it down to three. There was myself, a guy called Chris Bennett, and a guy called Dave Williams. And we all went in and did 1 hour. It was the Monday before Cup Day. So Tracy never came in that day. So we all went in and did a day. An hour each. And
Tracy Bartram.
Yeah. I was okay. I don't think I did very well. Chris Bennett got the job to be the third person. And then the boss rang me a couple of weeks later and said, would you be interested in doing the show anyway? they made a thing for me. They said they wanted me to just come in and do gossip. And yeah. And so I just did gossip. And then, due to very unfortunate circumstances, Chris had to leave the show. And they tried maybe like 10, 12 people to fill in that spot. And my boss just said, look, can you just sit there? Do you mind just laughing while everyone's doing their job? I'm like, yeah, that's easy. I can laugh.
That. Yeah. And the best thing, I mean, you have a signature laugh. I mean, yeah, I can hear that laugh annoying. And straight away know what it is.
Mm.
You know, that's a great gig to have when your laugh is so noticeable that people go, that's a wall of the room.
Yeah.
You know, but that's sort of how it all begins.
Yeah.
But there's so many people out there that would be desperate to get into that, you know, part of radio, breakfast radio in Melbourne.
Yeah.
Most coveted spot. Like, people want it. Have you ever had people come up to you wanting advice on how to do it?
Yeah, occasionally.
And you say luck, chance and circumstance.
No. It's, I managed to find a niche for myself. I managed to get onto a show that I had been rejected from, you know, and that was not about just because I was there. Like, it's about making the most of any opportunity. And also just about, you know, like I was saying before, like just being conscious that you're talking to one other person. Like, you can't be too annoying, you know? You can be, but it's not good.
You're going to have a very short career.
Yeah, and it's, you know, also it's an office job, and that's the thing that you have to learn really quickly. And I think that's been a lot of trouble for stand-ups doing radio is that, you know, we work doing stand-up till midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning, and then, you know, go out drinking till 2 or 3. So getting up at 4, an hour later than we normally go to bed, to go to work is it's the other end of the day, and it's an office job. So it's not the same camaraderie. It's not the same kind of drunken antics. Like, you have, you know, you're going to have fun because it's a fun job. Like, you know, your number one thing is making people laugh and trying to distract them from the fact that they're going to be in traffic for another 45 to 50 minutes. Mm. It's...
But you still have to be very mindful of the fact that you're working with 9-to-5ers
in
a corporate environment.
But also the people who are listening, they are also 9-to-5ers. they are also, you know, the people who are in the cars, they're going to do a 9-to-5 job. So having that office mindset as soon as you get to work is really important.
Well, it's relatable. You're like, that's at the end of the day, you're trying to be people's eyes and ears on that show.
Yeah.
You want people to go, oh, I believe him.
Yeah.
I think the same thing.
And the same thing with gossip. It's like, you know, people, like there were a lot of people on the network who wanted to kind of, because I worked on like 5 or 6 different stations. They were like, there was one guy particularly in Sydney who desperately wanted my job, but he was like really polished and really rehearsed. And I always used to say the secret to gossip for me is it needs to sound like gossip. It needs to sound like, so I would read all the information and then I would go to the studio and I would just try and remember it. Because that's how gossip works.
Yeah.
Like, you're just trying to remember. It's like, oh, you know that girl? She's in that film. Like, that sounds natural.
What is it? Around the water cooler?
Yeah, water cooler talk, yeah.
What do you reckon the biggest lesson is that you've ever learnt?
I think you keep learning. Like, you know, that's...
That's the biggest lesson, be open?
Yeah. Like, mistakes are learning experiences. Like, there's, you know, there's never anything I've gone, oh, I wish I hadn't done that. There's things where you go, you know what I should have done in that instance? Like, that's what you should think. You should never sit there going, oh, God, if only I hadn't said this. You think, oh, I should have said this. Like, it's, you know, I sometimes I'll teach, like, little classes to stand-ups, and one week I went, look, I know the one thing everyone wants to learn, and that's how to do crowd work. How do you talk to people in the audience? And I said, the only way to talk to people in the audience is to fail at it. Like, it's the only way you learn.
Is that because you won't do that again?
No, it's because, so you'll be chatting to someone in the audience, it'll be very boring, it'll be going nowhere, and you'll be like, oh, God, why couldn't I think of anything funny? And then you'll be driving home from the gig, and you're like, oh, you know what I should have said? This. And you'll think of something hysterical. Now, there is only a finite number of responses people have to questions. So next time you ask someone and they answer that thing, you're like, oh, I've got something prepared from last time I failed at this. And the more you fail, the funnier you get with talking to people in the audience.
What about over time looking at role models? Like, who would you say your biggest role models have been?
It depends who I'm learning stuff from. Like, I learned a lot from Will Anderson. I know he's younger than me, but he started stand-up before I did. And, you know, when we were first starting out, you know, it's like being on the dole and occasionally going and doing a gig. Like, the first few years of stand-up, you don't do anything during the day. So we had lunch every day for about a year and a half. And
wow. But yeah, that's an education in itself.
Yeah, and he is... love stand-up. So he would just, you know, spew information. So I took a lot from him. I learned a lot about hosting stand-up shows from Michelle Laurie, because she was one of my favourite stand-ups. She was so good, and I wish she would do it again. You know, I learned a lot about radio from Joe Stanley, from Matt Tilley, obviously, from just persistence of your career. Joan Rivers, that documentary about Joan Rivers, where you just go, yeah, You just don't stop. Like,
it's always going.
It's like a shark. Like, I don't, like, you know how they say sharks have to swim or they die? What the thing with sharks is, like, they don't have muscles in their gills to pump the water in and out. So they swim with their mouth open, and that pushes the water through their gills so they get the oxygen. So it's that. It's, you just keep going.
Is the comedy circuit very competitive?
It probably is. I don't know. It's, you know, you're asking a shark what it's like to hang out with fish. It probably is competitive. And I remember when I was younger and starting out, it was a little bit. But, and if you are a white 20-something dude who does nothing but get stoned with his friends and dresses abominably, and there are like about 300 of them doing stand-up. So it probably is competitive for them. But anyone who has any point of difference, if you are just the tiniest bit funny, you will get a long way very quickly because there are a lot of those stone dudes out there not doing anything different from one another.
Is there a different level of satisfaction between doing radio and doing stand-up?
Oh, yeah. It's very different. Like, you... radio, you kind of... I mean, it's fun in the studio. Mm. It's kind of like... I would say it's like, you know, when there's a bunch of you, it's like when you go to a pub and you're all having a laugh and... but you're just not drunk and smell of cigarettes afterwards. Like, you're in an office. It's weird. It's a weird situation. But stand-up is, you know, there's a room full of people that are laughing and you can see their faces and you get that energy of that joy coming up onto the stage and it's like, woo, I feel amazing.
So which one's better, would you say?
They have each have their own.
Oh, come on. You've got to pick one.
I can't pick one.
So it's like having two children. You just can't pick one.
It's like asking me to cut off one of my arms.
Sophie's choice.
I need one. Sophie's choice.
The worst analogy I could give you right now. You're like, Ben, you can't possibly be saying this to me. But Sophie's choice. Pick a baby. Pick a baby.
Am I going to get an Oscar at the end of this choice? Because it's the only way I'm making that choice.
It's going to be made of chocolate, but I'm going to give it to you.
Radio is much more, like, it's more lucrative financially, but it is also really stressful, and I certainly don't want to get up in the morning anymore. And stand-up is immediate, and, you know, but having said that, you know what? I love the job I'm doing at the moment more than anything I've done in a really long time, and that is the weirdest thing in the world because I'm not on screen. I'm just writing.
And this is the job that you reckon...
I love it so much. It is... I mean... Like with Celebrity Splash, where I learned something and learned a new thing, and this is something I did not expect to be happening, you know, at the age of 47, but every day I learn new things.
You know, talking about so many things in the media that's happened over the last 2 years with the plebiscite coming through, you know, and talking about the LGBTI landscape, how did you feel as they were talking about marriage equality?
Well, I didn't really care about it for a long time because... It's, you know, it's a level of conformity that I feel we shouldn't have to have. But on the other hand, it costs thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars in solicitor's fees to get the same kind of rights that you get automatically if you get married. So on a legal level, I'm like, yes, it's necessary. On a level of human rights and equality, I'm like, yes, I want it. But the other hand, I was like, I did not want the plebiscite, the survey, because it felt, well, it just felt like an excuse for a whole bunch of awful people to be awful. Mm. Like it was, I was never in any doubt that the nation would vote the way they did, but the rhetoric that was coming out, the number of things that I started to see that were on the no side, and, you know, they did a survey. There were like four no stories for every yes story in the media, made me think that, oh, no, this is actually going to fail. This is actually going to be a big fat no. The other thing I was distressing about it was that it was, if it was a no, then it was definitely a no. But if it was a yes, they'd still have to vote on it in Parliament. So it wasn't automatically a yes. That was distressing. It was not the reasonable debate that that we were promised. And it did affect my mental health. Like, I started to feel like I did as a teenager. I started to feel like, you know, we all go through this period where it's like, I just wish I wasn't me. Like, life would be so much easier if I wasn't the way I am. And that is not the way anyone should feel. Like, if a 47-year-old man who has been comfortable with their sexuality since they were 12 feels like that, then there is something wrong with the process. And I hate to think what happened with kids. I lost a very dear friend of mine in that process. I don't know what his decision was when he decided that he didn't want to be part of this world anymore, but he took his own life in between before the announcement was made, and he kind of hung on for a while unconscious in a coma and then died, and I was a pallbearer at his funeral, and it was just one of those things where the day everyone was celebrating was the day he passed away. And I was just like, I can't celebrate this. I can't in good conscience say this is a great day in our country's history because the cost was too high. Like, the amount of depression, the number of people who, because I was quite upfront about it on social media, I would have people saying, yes, I feel the same. Thank you for vocalizing that. You know, I don't know why it's upset me so much. And it's like, yeah, it kind of cut all of us really deep. And yes, I'm glad we've got it, but the price shouldn't have been that high. We shouldn't have had to go through what we went through to get it.
And I don't think, personally, that Malcolm Turnbull would probably ever understand or believe that that was really what was happening, because you know that story and I'm very sorry that you know that story, but that story is not completely uncommon.
No.
During that time. And you're so right when you realise that every gay person, every queer person in Australia was reduced to that teenage self where they genuinely wish that they were somebody else.
Yes, and also, on the other hand, had to pretend that everything's fine and that, yes, we want it. Yes, we're voting yes. Come on, everyone. Even that was upsetting, like seeing people, you know, posting with their envelopes at the letterbox going, I'm voting yes, and straight people, I'm your number one ally. I'm like, yeah, sure you are. Go away. Like, it felt patronising for the people who were saying yes. I was like, just, you know, I don't want to feel like I'm some sort of basket case that needs to be dragged through a legislative process by all of my allies. Like, I'm a robust individual. Why can't I be in charge of my own destiny? But, yeah, feeling like my, you know, future was being decided by a whole bunch of people that had nothing to do with me was...
insulting.
Yeah, it was awful.
How do you feel about it now?
Now I'm like, well, I'm glad we've got it. I'm really upset that I'm going to have to get rid of a whole lot of stand-up I've done about it. But, yeah, it's, you know, I'm glad it's here. And the other thing is, like, I felt like I just wanted to shake the opponents and go, you do realise this is the last thing. This is the last thing we need to have equality. And once this happens, we will go away. As a community, as a group, we will dissipate into just normalcy. I hate that word, but that's what's going to happen. Like, your neighbours will just, you know, be lesbians. You'll bump into some gay people down at IKEA. Like, it will... we're just going to be part of society, and then that's it.
But it's, I think it's really interesting that you say that. And I must admit, and I believe the same thing as you did for a very long time, but it wasn't until I started sort of investigating a little bit further that I realised that, you know... one of two things was happening, and that is that there's new things that as a community we probably still need to look for more visibility of, with, you know, transgender people and getting people to understand the diverse levels of the LGBTI alphabet. But also, one thing I realized is that we learned something so important that we can teach to other people of minority on how to stand up.
Yeah.
And how we can help them get their message across in a way that means that other people have to hear what they have to say.
Yeah.
And can we do something about it? So, like, it's really interesting that when something like this happens, you then sort of look back at it and think, what did we learn? Mm. And then where are we going now with this?
Yeah.
You know, what, I mean, is there anything that you believe that as a part of the LGBTI community that is missing that we probably should be highlighting?
Oh, look, there probably are, but, you know, it's, like you say, it's a diverse community. It's a community of communities. Like, there are small splinter communities and they're, you know, it could be, you know, the bear community needs someone to talk to them about their carb intake.
Probably.
The twink community need someone to talk to them about body shaming. You know, there are things within those smaller communities that need to happen, but that's not something you can do the way this has happened on a huge national scale. You know, I can't speak for the trans community because I'm not a trans person. And it's one of those things I'm like, oh my God, that is a journey I cannot even begin to understand. Like, you're talking about taking hormones for the rest of your life, so it's like you're going through some weird combination of puberty and menopause forever. I can't speak about lesbians. Like, I can't even really talk about twinks. Like, I can just talk about me. I can talk about me and my experience as me, and anyone that can vaguely hook into that, whether it's because they grew up poor or they're now fat or they're bald or they're gay or they've got a boyfriend who owns property in Sydney. Whatever it is, like, whatever you want to hook into, that's the thing we have in common. But, you know.
Before that and after that, you probably feel like that's not your story.
No, it's not. I have lesbian friends, but I can't talk for them.
How do you feel now? Do you think that there's going to be more people in, like, sporting roles or TV roles that are going to feel comfortable, like, about coming out with their sexuality?
Probably. Like, I think it's just going to be, like, a non-issue now. Like, it's, you know, people are quite... the sexuality is quite fluid now. Like, people are kind of... it's not a big deal. for teenagers. It's, you know, oh yeah, I kissed a girl on the weekend. Oh, I had sex with that guy. Like, it's that's the new world we live in. And I want to say I'm jealous of it, but, you know, I had such an amazing time dancing at nightclubs with blacked-out windows so no one could see in, and they're going to miss out on that because they're just going to sit at home and Grindr and order it in like Menu Log. So,
isn't it sad when you go to the clubs now and they're not as busy as what they were back in the day?
And like, you feel like such a creep. old creep.
And I'm really sorry, but I don't feel like an old creep, but I've always felt like a creep at every gay nightclub I've ever been to. What do you think about this? Do you reckon there was a real tipping point for a lot of queer people that we started talking about equality more as our mantra and less about sexualizing ourselves? And in the fight for marriage equality, you know, we sort of stopped. You saw rallies where people were using like sexual images, or it was very in your face, and then instead it sort of became about equality. What do you think the change was there?
Oh, I think it was, please give us this thing, we'll behave the way you want us to.
To give us the answer that we want.
Yeah.
But do you reckon that means that over time, like Mardi Gras and things like that are going to become less sexualized?
Maybe. I mean, Mardi Gras, this is another thing that this is the way of all gay things. It started out as a protest and now it's a party.
Forever.
Yeah. And, yeah, I think it's, I don't know, it's hard to predict behaviour, though. Like, it's hard to go, oh, I think this will happen. Like, you know, I honestly did believe for a while. Like, at the start, I was like, oh, yeah, you know, marriage equality is going to happen. And then I was like, oh, maybe it's not. Maybe I feel depressed because that's, you know, that's the prevailing attitude.
Yeah, it's going to be the big kick in the teeth.
And then it's like, oh, no, we've got it now, it's fine. Yeah, so I don't know. It's like, I feel like we live in a weird world. I feel like I'm of a generation of gay men who we've had to set the agenda and none of us know what we're doing because we have no mentors. Like the generation before us, there are very few people left and there's not enough people to be mentors for everyone. Like, you know, it was decimated by the AIDS virus. So I feel like we're the largest group of gay men of this age. Like, you know, we're the oldest and we don't know what we're doing. And I feel like when people say things like trailblazer, it's like there was just no one else.
So we had to do it.
We have to. Like, we had to be on the forefront of these things because, you know, it probably would have happened if so many people hadn't died, then all of this equality stuff would have probably happened a generation earlier because there was kind of that push towards equality, but then it became a matter of survival. Like, it was just, oh, as a community, how do we survive? Like, how do we stop this decimation that's going on? How do we stop people dying? Mm. And now that we've got combination therapy followed by PrEP, and now, you know, it's like it's not a terrible death sentence, so now it's like, oh, now we can get on with the other things we needed, like marriage equality and things like that. So it's, I feel like we've had to be, as a generation, none of us wanted this. And that was one of the things I really loved about this Mardi Gras anniversary was all the people talking about the 78ers and the, you know, the ones who've survived and the ones who are still going. You're just like, yeah, they were doing, it was a big deal. And yeah, it was only 5 years later that they all started dying. So it's like, you think if that hadn't happened, maybe we would be further along now. Things happened the way they did, and now we have to, this is the course we're charting.
If you've got a message for the queer community that's listening to this right now, what message would you give them?
Please stop paying attention to me. I don't need it. My mother always said, stop laughing. You're just giving him attention. He's going to keep doing it.
But do you think there's a message for the next generation?
Yeah. Don't make it hard for yourself. Like, it was hard enough for us, like, just because of the world. Like, don't beat yourself up. There's you've got nothing to worry about.
Thank you so much for coming in here today and sharing your story. It's been as funny as it has been heartwarming. And I think there's lots of people that are going to get something out of this.
Probably an infection.
There's a cream for that. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, honey.
Word for Word is presented and produced by Benjamin Norris from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy. Word for Word is distributed nationally to over 70 radio stations across the community radio network.
SER wishes to acknowledge the custodians of the land from which we broadcast, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation and the Wadumatagal clan of the Darug Nation, and their elders past, present and emerging. We acknowledge and respect their continuing culture and the contribution they make to the life of this city and this region.
In a society inundated with technology,
one podcast will set out to document the weird, the wonderful and mind-boggling stories of the digital age. Think. Digital Futures.
Finding the human in the machine. Tune in 6:30 p.m. Tuesdays or 10:30 a.m. Sundays.
Brought to you by the University of Technology Sydney and 2SER 107.3.
Oh yeah! 2SER 107.3.